This is Encounter on VOA. Here's Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. On this edition of the program, our periodic update on Africa. Despite Russia's unprovoked, unlawful invasion of Ukraine, some African regimes continue to either court or host mercenaries from the Kremlin-linked Wagner Group. The Malian government has shown a preference for the Wagner Group over international actors like France to train and advise its security forces and to conduct counterterrorism operations. We'll talk about the so-called Moura massacre at the end of March, which involved the execution of approximately 300 men. Human Rights Watch alleges that this military operation amounted to, quote, the worst single atrocity reported in Mali's decades-long conflict, unquote. During a UN General Assembly vote on April 7 to suspend Russia from the UN Human Rights Council, why did a majority of sub-Saharan African countries either vote against the move or abstain? Not surprisingly, many which voted against Moscow's removal were among the least democratic, such as Zimbabwe, Central African Republic, Mali, Gabon, Burundi, Eritrea, and Ethiopia. Speaking of the Horn of Africa, we will also examine the deleterious impact of the drought affecting parts of Ethiopia, Kenya, and Somalia. The World Food Program warns that more than 20 million people in the affected area could face catastrophic levels of hunger due to food insecurity precipitated by the lack of rainfall. And what is the status of Ethiopia's bloody civil war, where there have been frequent allegations of ethnic cleansing targeting people from the northern Tigray region? Human Rights Watch and Amnesty International released a report this month documenting systematic killing or evicting of hundreds of ethnic Tigrayans by authorities in the Amhara region. The Economist magazine concludes that, quote, the campaign carried out with the connivance of federal authorities was as methodical as it was brutal, unquote. And is there any hope for reversing the military takeover of Sudan? Just as the country was on the brink of transitioning to democracy after decades of authoritarian rule, the military staged a coup in October 2021. For more on the political and humanitarian crises in Ethiopia, Sudan, and Sahel, we turn to two distinguished regional analysts. Joshua Meservey is Senior Policy Analyst for Africa and the Middle East at the Heritage Foundation, that's based here in Washington, and Susan Stigand, she's Director of Africa Programs at the U.S. Institute of Peace, also based here in Washington. And both panelists join me via Microsoft Teams. Welcome to the program.
Thanks, Carol.
Thanks, Carol.
So, Joshua Meservey, let me begin with you. Let's start with the drought-induced famine in the Horn. How dire is the situation, and what are the impediments, in your view, to addressing it?
It's difficult to know for sure, of course, because the region in which it's happening and the specific countries in which it's happening, it's very difficult to get access to some of these places. And this will get to the second part of your question. Why is this famine going on? So yes, there are environmental factors. You mentioned the droughts. There's been successive locust invasions that have put a lot of pressure on the food supplies in these areas. But then you've also had conflict and you've had very poor governance. Ethiopia, Somalia, just looking at those two, Ethiopia has been involved in a civil war for well over a year now. A lot of the hunger that international organizations are warning about are in the north, where the civil war began in the Tigray state. And the government of Ethiopia, based in Addis Ababa, has restricted and even entirely cut off at times any sort of aid access to Tigray. So that's very clearly exacerbated this famine. And then you can look at Somalia, which is perpetually unstable. They're in the midst of a very contentious electoral process that's going poorly. You have the Al-Qaeda-linked Al-Shabaab terrorist organization that's still very active in many parts of the country, which complicates this as well. So you have a bit of a perfect storm here. You've got the environmental factors, but mostly I would say the biggest problem is the instability, the violence, and the poor governance that's making it so much harder to address these food insecurity issues.
Turning to you, Susan Stigand, a perfect storm in terms of factors that are precipitating this widespread hunger? How do you see it?
Yeah, Carol, I think there's cause for really deep concern. It's striking to me because there has been significant investment in leadership across the Horn of Africa. In fact, the regional economic community, the Intergovernmental Authority on Development, was really initially established to look at questions that included the development side and the risks of these types of shocks. But as Josh said, I think it would be too narrow just to look at this from what's happening with the climate. Obviously, the realities of climate are incredibly complex. In addition to what Josh outlined, the region was significantly impacted by the COVID-19 pandemic. And while I think for many people living in the United States, the first order impacts were health, and the second order impacts have been economic, I think it's quite the inverse across the Horn of Africa. So at a moment when people's resilience, when their reserves, when their backups, the other ways that they can care for themselves and their families and communities in the midst of an external shock, people are already in quite difficult situations. And the economic consequences of the conflicts in the region are also incredibly significant. You highlighted that we'll speak about Sudan later, but in many ways, the economy is back to a situation that's worse prior to the revolution. In Ethiopia, deep concern with the ongoing crisis and conflict. I will say that in any of these circumstances, that there is a tremendous need for resources and support. And I think given what's happening globally at the moment, there's concern that mobilizing the necessary humanitarian partnership and response will be very, very difficult. And I think this is something that the World Food Program is trying to ring the alarm bells to say, certainly the situation in Ukraine is grave and serious, and 15 million souls in the Horn of Africa also need that attention and support.
And I would like to point out that, as you said, the World Food Program is trying to ring the alarm, and it is severely underfunded. It says that it has just received 13% of a required $370 million since the appeal was launched in January. So we'll keep an eye on this. But I'd like now to turn to West Africa, to Mali in particular. Joshua Mazurvi, since a coup d'etat unseated the government in 2020, as you know, the French have withdrawn their troops that were helping to fight terrorists, and the new military junta has welcomed this shadowy Russian-backed Wagner group. It's a group of Kremlin-backed mercenaries who have been implicated in a massacre in Mora in southern central Mali. These mercenaries seem to be further exacerbating tensions and instability. What more do we know, Joshua, about Mali's security partnership with Russia and the shadowy Wagner group in particular? Do you think it may pose even an equal or greater threat than the very Al-Qaeda and Islamic State-linked extremists that continue to bedevil Mali?
It's difficult to get a really firm grasp on what Wagner is up to because by design, they disguise what they're doing. And then their partners in African governments are happy to do that as well. So in Mali, as you pointed out, there's reason to be very concerned that they were involved in this massacre where as many as 300 people were executed or killed in some brutal fashion. This shouldn't surprise us. Just observing what's going on in Ukraine, we know that the Russian military behaves in brutal fashion. It's very much part of how they operate. Now, Wagner is different than the Russian military, but it is populated by many former Russian soldiers, and it appears to have that very same ethic about how it wages war. And then again, in the case of Mali and in other African countries where it has operated, it has a partner in a local African government that also does not appear to have any sort of concern for the human rights of its own people. That's a very toxic combination. And we, frankly and sadly, should be prepared to see more of this sort of brutality from Wagner. We've seen it in other African countries, in the Central African Republic, for instance. There have been credible reports of Wagner-involved massacres there as well. So this is just one part of the concern that the West and others have about Wagner's operations in Africa. Another concern would be that they're very clearly a Russian government proxy. The Russian government, of course, will claim that it has nothing to do with Wagner, but that's ludicrous. They very clearly are part of Russian government activity. And So we have to be concerned that where Wagner is, where we see the spread of Russian influence, we see the disruption and the instability that Wagner brings, we see the resource extraction, the rent-seeking activities that they involve themselves in. It seems that they're being paid by these African governments, at least in part, with natural resources that should belong to the people of these countries, but instead they're being funneled and siphoned off to this Wagner group who are involved, it seems, in trafficking and smuggling. So there's a whole host of problems with the Wagner group's activities. Unfortunately, as I say, I don't see them going anywhere in the near term. I think that these African governments that have contracted their services find them really useful because they have no compunctions about human rights. They're happy to engage in very brutal behavior, which African governments may even approve of or wish for. And Wagner asks none of the same sorts of pesky questions about things like human rights that the US or the Europeans would ask, for instance. So I fear that Wagner is going to be in Africa for the foreseeable future. I wouldn't be surprised if we see other African countries start to contract with them as well. And the US and its allies really need to think long and hard about how they deal with this challenge moving forward.
Well, that leads me to ask you, Susan, how do you think the United States and allies are prepared to deal with the Wagner group and the backsliding in democracy, which seems to be leading African governments or these juntas to partner with the Wagner group and other, you know, Russian mercenaries, etc.? It's very disturbing. I can't imagine it's not being considered by the United States. And of course, another worrying factor is that the Malians, probably because they were brainwashed, you know, seem to be welcoming the Russians and, you know, saying, you know, good riddance to the French.
Yes, it's in many ways a very complicated landscape. And as you alluded to, I think what we see happening in Mali is indicative of some of these trends of the coups that have taken place, really an alarming and historic number across Africa, and particularly concentrated in the Sahel over the past couple of years, in this sort of another perfect storm with the real threats, the real urgent threats of violent extremism and the deep frustration of citizens that their governments are not able to deliver. They're not able to deliver basic security, not able to deliver education for their children, hospitals, roads, basic water. And I think that this gives quite dangerous openings. And it's a tricky approach to address. But I think some of the areas where we see some possibilities is really trying to bolster the roles of the regional bodies like the Economic Community of West African States that has taken a strong stand in upholding the continent's norms and principles related to coups and what we refer to as unconstitutional changes of government. And this doesn't mean that the practice always matches the norms and the standards, but that's also true in every democracy, including the United States itself. We know that one of the challenges is strengthening the capacity of a security sector that actually protects citizens while also addressing real security threats. And so in very colloquial terms, how is it possible to ensure that people will run to security forces, run to people in uniforms rather than away from them? And I think that the reality of the kinetic and violent capacity that is being used and where citizens are either being caught up or targeted as part of operations is something where the United States has a series of legislation and principles about how security assistance is provided. The Biden-Harris administration has articulated a priority about supporting democracy, about supporting civil society, about supporting civic voices. And in these circumstances where countries are under the real threat of violent extremism, are going through these cycles of coups, it's really important to be able to step back and take sort of a medium-term view about what do we know, what have we learned over the many decades of what it best takes to prevent conflict and really promote stability. And I think there's some good practice that can be pulled forward in it. I would also say that while our attention is on Mali, there's also a potential opportunity to prevent the spread of these risks into countries along the region in coastal West Africa. Many countries are facing similar threats and challenges. And I think the U.S. has an opportunity to think about how it can invest in partners that are trying to find democratic, nonviolent solutions to the challenges before things get too acute and it gets much more difficult to turn around.
You're listening to Encounter on the Voice of America, and joining me via Microsoft Teams are Joshua Meservey, Senior Policy Analyst for Africa and the Middle East at the Heritage Foundation, and Susan Stigand, from whom you just heard. She's Director of Africa Programs at the U.S. Institute of Peace, and we're discussing an update on Africa. This is a reminder that our Encounter podcast is available for free download on our website at voanews.com/encounter. You may also follow us on Twitter or connect with us on Facebook at Carol Castiel, VOA. Here's a shout out to a new Twitter follower from Ethiopia, Abderisak D. Haji. If you want to hear your name and home country on the air, please send an email to encounter@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. And we would like to wish all of our Muslim listeners across the world Ramadan Kareem. I just mentioned Ethiopia, so let's turn to that, Joshua Meservey. Can you give us a brief status of the conflict and perhaps give us your feedback on the Human Rights Watch report of atrocities?
I'll give sort of a general overview of what we think we know is going on in Ethiopia right now in terms of the conflict. So my analysis is that we've somewhat settled into a stalemate. There's certainly been no resolution of this conflict. It does appear to be at a lower tempo than certainly it was even 3 or 4 months ago. But the Tigray party, the rebel group that operates out of the Tigray state, certainly has not surrendered. It certainly has not reconciled with the central government, and the central government hasn't given many indications of making a really concerted effort to reconcile with the Tigrayans either. So both sides seem to, while they might occasionally make reference to desiring peace or looking for a mediated solution, there hasn't been much evidence on the ground that they are really committed or putting all of their energies into pursuing that sort of path. So we still have that hostility. So the Tigrayans have largely retreated back into Tigray state after coming out and trying to march to Addis Ababa and overthrow the government. They were stopped. Once they left Tigray, they're outside of friendly territory. They moved into very hostile territory. That was much harder fighting for them. They were also more out in the open, and they were hit pretty hard by drones especially. So that is what's happening with the Tigrayans. But we need to remember that there are multiple elements of this broader conflict. Another one is happening in Oromia, and there's still very significant fighting happening in Oromia, which is the region that encompasses Addis Ababa and large sections of the south. There you have an Oromo rebel group that is still involved in, as I say, significant fighting. It's very difficult to get good information out of there to know exactly what the status is of the front lines, if you can even call them front lines. Everything is so fluid that it's hard to draw any sort of reliable front lines in this conflict. And then you also have localized fighting in other areas as well, some of which is connected to the broader struggle that some rebel groups are waging against the government, and other conflicts that are just inter-ethnic violence or struggle over local control of land and things of that nature. So it's very complex, very difficult to get good information out of there about exactly what's happening on the ground. I think we can safely say that Ethiopia still appears to be a long ways away from any sort of reconciliation. As I mentioned in my earlier comments, I just haven't seen anything that convinces me that the central government or the Tigrayans or the Oromos or all these different groups involved in the fighting are really committed to seeking a negotiated settlement. Again, there's occasional rhetoric, but it doesn't match the reality on the ground. And I think that, frankly, all sides might have to fight themselves to exhaustion before they get to the place where they're really committed to negotiating in good faith. So hopefully we will get there soon. But for now, I think Ethiopia is going to be in a real sustained struggle for the foreseeable future.
Susan Stigand, do you see Ethiopia in a similar light, that it's going to be in a sustained conflict for the foreseeable future? As Joshua reminded us, that it's not just Tigray and the central government. There doesn't seem to be any sense of goodwill toward true reconciliation.
I think there have been some potential spots of light without overstating what those are. The humanitarian truce that was declared at the end of March, both by the federal government and the Tigray Defense Forces, I think opened a possibility to end the humanitarian blockade, to start to get some absolutely critical humanitarian assistance into Tigray, and then potentially to open some further momentum towards discussing the interim security arrangements that would be needed and broadening out to the other groups who are influencing and who are impacted by the fighting. But a humanitarian truce by itself doesn't end a blockade, and it doesn't necessarily tip into a broader peace agreement that is both signed and can be verified and can turn into something other than just a piece of paper. Some of the things that I watch for is whether there are sort of subsequent steps that are taken by the respective parties, whether the trust can be built with a more steady flow of humanitarian assistance into Tigray, but also into the neighboring Afar region. I think we also need to keep an eye towards what's happening with other armed forces that are involved in this conflict, areas of the Amhara state. Similarly, we haven't talked about it yet, but Eritrea, a separate neighboring country that used to be part of one country, has its defense forces deployed as part of this civil crisis. And that has been an incredibly difficult point to actually address. And I think if we look at what's happening in the broader global context, that it doesn't become any easier. I also think it's important to say that there are a lot of people who are working very hard for peace. And that doesn't mean that the gradient of power is necessarily with them. But I think there are serious initiatives within Oromia region, for example, to foster a dialogue process that isn't based around violence or the use of force, and to try to think through what does an Oromo vision look like going forward and how does that fit into the country. There is a lot of skepticism about the national dialogue that has been announced and the commission established by the Ethiopian government. I think rightly so. There are questions about, is it the right time to have a national dialogue amidst a humanitarian crisis? And is the commission itself sufficiently inclusive? And I think there's broad agreement that this would have to be built incrementally over time and sequenced with other progress in terms of the violence and the conflict.
And as we close, Joshua, very briefly, anything to comment about the situation in Sudan? We talked about what a positive transition to democracy we thought was taking place, and then the coup happened in October. Where do we stand right now? Can the transition to democracy be reinvigorated?
As you referenced, there was a very hopeful democratic transition going on there. The coup has short-circuited. And I think that the security services, of course, who launched the coup and now are in total control of the government, have proven what many of us suspected, and that is that they will not be party to any sort of arrangement that threatens their equities. So they want to maintain their involvement in the Sudanese economy. They want to maintain ultimate political power so that they can protect themselves from things like war crimes trials, and that they can simply rule as they see fit. So I think they've proven that they are not interested in sharing meaningful power with civilians. So now it is up once again to the Sudanese people, who continue to protest very bravely. It's incredibly inspirational. They were the ones that forced the initial coup, and then against Omar al-Bashir several years ago. And then also they stayed in the streets and forced the military to surrender some power to civilians. But now they have to do it again. And they really are, I think, the only ones who can be decisive here.
Susan Stigant, you get the last word on Sudan.
I think that's right, Carol. I think the protesters in Sudan, they're brave, they're courageous. They're also incredibly well organized. And the mobilization at the community level to articulate political demands and expectations, to transfer those to political representatives and parties, and then to set an agenda for what is expected from any future government. I think if there's any place in the world where Biden-Harris administration could be thinking seriously about how to advance its democracy agenda, this is a country where you have the domestic engine fuel commitment to drive that forward.
A conversation to be continued, but for now, that's all the time we have on this edition of Encounter. I'd like to thank my guests, Joshua Meservey, Senior Policy Analyst for Africa and the Middle East at the Heritage Foundation, and Susan Stigand, Director of Africa Programs at the U.S. Institute of Peace. Encounter was produced in Washington with technical assistance from Rick Pantaleo. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Encounter on The Voice of America.